This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing?
Good. Good to hear your voice again.
Excellent. It's Nate G., Dr. Lyle, the Beat Your Genes podcast. We took a week off last week for Thanksgiving, but we are back full steam ahead today. We've got a lot of questions today. We've got 10, and we're going to try to get to as many as we can, and the ones we don't get to, we are going to go with next week. So, Dr. Lyle, let's power through this. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's just do it.
All right, let's just do it. Okay, so last week, the future episode, we had a couple of follow-up questions from that, but the one that we're going to read is, Dear Dr. Lyle, you talked about how we are all going to be wealthy and everyone's going to be cheap. Everything is going to be cheap thanks to technology advancements. That all makes sense, but I want to understand the future of our actual society. If, as you say, Dr. Lyle, we'll have robots doing everything such as paving our roads, what happens to the jobs and earning a living for the humans? Even if things are cheap, we have to earn some money, right? Will it be a service-based economy where each person only needs to do about 5 hours of work per week to earn our equivalent of 40 hours today? So would a restaurant have like 10 different managers and 100 different servers that rotate shifts? All I'm really trying to ask is what happens when we don't need 150 million Americans working anymore?
Yes, it's a good question, just because the person's sort of imagining the future as I'm seeing that it would unfold. However, this kind of question, it's a type of question that has often been raised, and there's been worry about. It's the same kind of question that took place when they got computerized welders inside of the automobile factories. So suddenly there's a bunch of guys that used to make a really good union wage welding cars, and they no longer can weld. There's no work for them to be done. So the question is, oh, my God, well, what are the welders going to do? Answer, they're going to do something else. And so job after job after job has been eliminated. For example, a lot of accountants or bookkeepers are no longer employed in the same capacity doing the same things that they might have been doing 30 years ago because you've got QuickBooks and TurboTax and things of that nature. So there's no end of innovation, and so innovation will continue to take people's jobs away. You remember that you used to dial 411 and an operator would say, you know, Pacific Bell, can I help you? And then you're going to ask them to look up a number. And so that was a hugely expensive process that the phone companies had to provide for us back in. I mean, we got a lot of young listeners that don't know that even existed. But the point is that was a huge national job, was to be an operator for the phone company. So, of course, as technology continues to take over those jobs, they're going to go away, and then people do something else. Now, the people that are looking at this and saying, yes, but what else could they do? And here's the issue. The issue is that human desires are infinite. And that's something that the naive folks, and I'm not saying stupid, I'm saying naive because the question here was naive, It's a naive concept that people only want X amount of whatever it is, because today it would be sufficing, whatever it is. So today it suffices us to have X number of square feet to ourselves, but we can see already that that is not the case. We can see that when people can afford it, they bump it up to, you know, a family of four starts looking at 1,000 square foot a human. Is kind of where it is that they are, looks like they're landing. We don't know if that's going to go to 8,000 square or 2,000 square feet a human. Maybe, maybe not. Probably not. The et cetera, et cetera. So now let's. Can we imagine what people are going to do? Not really. We couldn't have imagined 50 years ago or 60 years ago that so many people would be involved in making computers and servicing computers or writing software. We wouldn't have had a dream that the software industry would be the industry that it is today. So it's very difficult to imagine what the market, what human desires will emerge as important, even though we know in principle what they are, but we don't know how. A friend of mine who's all interested, by the way, a friend of mine is quite interested in sex robots. And so I come by this information honestly, just for everybody who's listening. And so it turns out, he keeps explaining to me that sex robots are on the verge of an extraordinary boom and revolution. Now, that wouldn't surprise me at all. So there will probably be...
Can you say that it's kind of reaching a climax? Is that how you put it?
Oh, that was good. Very good. But the point is here is that there's no end to what it is that people are going to want. I expect that we may very well, I mean, just as I look into the future, I can see a tremendous amount more of exquisite beach property being developed around the world in a way that it isn't, just because airplane flights will be much, much cheaper. They'll be faster. And not only will they be cheaper and faster, but it will also be the case that people will have the time and money to lie on the beach. And so I expect that there's going to be a lot more regions of the world that look like Cancun, etc. But the question is a good question, but it comes from this naive notion that there would be limited human desires and therefore limited demand, and the demand is infinite. So there's no end to what it is that human might continue to want, and therefore people, even though they will be spectacularly wealthy by today's standards, as the people are today spectacularly wealthy by the standards of 1850, even though they will be spectacularly wealthy, they will still be wanting to satisfy a lot of their infinite material desires, and so therefore they will still be willing to work. Now, I think we're going to see that they're not going to be willing to work. Not very many people are going to be willing to work as hard as most people work today. Just as most people today do not work nearly as hard as their grandparents were working in the factories of 1950. So people today, there are people today that work very hard, but there are not very many of them. And most people are hanging around the water cooler. They're typing stuff on a computer. They're in an air conditioned and heat controlled office. They got a nice break for lunch. They hop in their beautiful car that is reliable. I mean, this is like unthinkable, you know, in by 1940 standards. And their biggest problem is making sure they try to not eat too many rich calories. That's insane relative to human history. So the problems of today are a joke compared to the problems of 50 or 100 years ago. And the problems of 100 years from now will be comical compared to the problems of today. People will not be working very hard. They will have a lot of time off. They will consider it a real annoyance to have to work 32 hours a week. in order to have their 8,000 square foot house with a gorgeous pool with a robot that keeps it all perfectly clean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there will be problems and resource constraints and decisions about how to spend one's life in the future, but there won't be any lack of demand, so there also won't be any lack of supply of labor. There will be supply and demand curves intersecting at various wage rates for various problems of various pleasantness. There'll be a lot of people trying to make livings as dancers and movie producers and actors and singers, just like there's a heck of a lot more people today trying to make their living in music than there were 50 years ago. It's not even close. So you can imagine in the world of tomorrow with increasing amount of ability to market to the entire world that everybody that can maybe find a way in a genre to sell 30,000 copies of their little tune will be in their cool personal little studio with their little high school friends in their big fancy house, and they'll be pumping out music and trying to build their little coalition of a little few fans and try to sell those things for, quote, a lot of money. So this is the ideas of tomorrow, but there won't be any lack of things for people to do in order to try to make some money.
And so circle back around to these sex robots. I really want to hear about that. Will there just be like a part of society that will just be all about the pleasure trap, sex, you know, salt, sugar, oil, drugs,
yeah,
alcohol, tobacco?
I actually think that's true. I think that and my friend's not a fool. He's a very sophisticated thinker, really quite a visionary in terms of his. He anticipated in a paper that he wrote more than 20 years ago the exact type of internet process that you see now. He imagined millions of little movie producers producing very short kinds of things, et cetera. It turned out he was absolutely right, and he was a lone voice or pretty close to it speaking along those lines. So now that he's looking at the sex robot trade, he says this thing is going to become phenomenal, and he very well could be right. So if there's some company out there that might need my attention in terms of a few dollars,
it sounds reasonable. Safer for all parties involved.
Sure.
No human trafficking problems. No abuse.
Right. Yes.
Well,
all sorts of things, and the ability of androids to learn to be responsive to a specific individual's desires. This could be really quite something. It's essentially a 21st century version of pornography. Pornography actually has been at the cutting edge of all media, whether it was print media, whether it was photography, whether it was telephone. There's phone sex clear back in the early 1900s. And now pornography drove tremendous amount of innovation on the internet. And so this is now it's coming to a culmination here with Android robots. It's going to be – don't think that – I mean, robotics has an awful lot of applications. You have robots do all kinds of things that are going to be potentially useful. But you can only imagine the dollar signs inside entrepreneurs' eyes in the robot industry, thinking about the extraordinary massive market behind sex robots. This is going to drive tremendous innovation in this field, just like it always has.
Hopefully they'll come up with something better than just cold metal. Okay, so next question.
Yes.
Okay, dear Dr. Lyle, I'm divorced, almost 2 years, 55 years old, not currently working, and I'm considering relocating somewhere with a more reasonable cost of living. I currently live in Southern California by myself, which is expensive. Most of my family lives in upstate New York, and I have a few friends scattered around Northern California, Washington, and Oregon, which I've also considered. I'm also considering somewhere warm with a low cost of living, like New Mexico and Arizona. So my question is this: do I move back to New York, where I have lots of extended family, but not super crazy about the weather, the demographics, or the area? Or do I move somewhere where I feel the demographics, weather, and area are more appealing, but I'll be alone? I've also dreamed of other scenarios, like just selling everything and moving to a tropical country, but I'm not sure that I have the risk tolerance for that.
Yeah, good question. So let's look at the way I try to solve problems is I try to solve them in principle. So there's a principled way to try to solve a problem like this, and that is right now this individual doesn't, it's not clear to them in their imagination what is the optimal solution. So when that's not clear, what we want to do is we want to do things that could give us more information so that we can evaluate the problem. So in this case, there are certain problems, different types of problems. If this person were telling me they couldn't figure out which Kleenex they should buy, I would tell them buy a box of each, and then you can compare them side by side, and then you've made that decision forever. Obviously, when you're trying to decide whether or not to have a child, you don't get to do that. You don't get to have a cheap and easy method for determining whether or not this is something that you want to do. So in this case, we have an intermediate level decision. We don't have a decision about a career on the horizon. We don't have a decision that we have a huge amount at stake. So in my judgment, what we do is we actually want to take a run at the unknown where there's a potential major upside. So this person already knows the cost-benefit of what it's like to, quote, go home to upstate New York. They know about the cold, the misery, and the freezing. And I've got a very
spoken like a true
friend outside of Buffalo, I think I'll stop it right there. but the point is that they already know what the score is there, and the cost benefit hanging over the head of those parameters is not a huge draw. It's a moderate draw. So there's the unknown upside that sits in Tucson or wherever else the person is considering. And my attitude would be look at a place that looks appealing, looks like it has some excitement to it that could fit pretty well, and go there. And and run the least expensive experiment that you can. And so that experiment might take you a year. It might take you 3 or 4 months to get a job. You might be on the job for a while, et cetera. And maybe you have to stay a year or two in order to not wreck your resume. I'm not sure what the person's situation is. But the point is that at 55 years old, if you're taking reasonable care of yourself, you have 30 years left to live. And so the notion here is explore the landscape a little bit and to see whether or not we can make an optimal decision. So if you go to a place that you think has the biggest upside and you go there for a year and you really dislike it and you're lonely and miserable and you really miss the freezing sleet, then then by all means you can always fall back on a decision where you already know the parameters. The whole point here is to run experiments to learn to get new information, and so that's the way that I would go about solving that problem.
Fantastic. Okay.
All right.
And Dr. Lyle, can you tell us a little bit why you decided to live in California versus anywhere else?
Well, you're trying to step me into alienating a bunch of people.
I'm sorry. I didn't even realize. I wasn't smart enough to pick up on.
No, I've actually lived many different places, and so I can understand the appeal of a lot of different places. Notice how smooth and politically correct that was. I've lived in Idaho. I've lived in Oregon. Lived in Northern and Southern California. I've lived in Texas. I've lived in Virginia. I've lived in Maryland. So I've lived, a fair amount of places, and I dislike the humidity of the the eastern seaboard, and I dislike the cold of the north, so that leaves the southwest. I dislike the dryness and heat of the desert and the look of the desert, so that puts me starts crowding me into Northern California.
I figured there must be some very methodical, logical reasons. I was just curious about that.
Right. So I know you're in L.A., and I know that 7 or 8 million people out there like Los Angeles, but I grew up there, and I like a little more rain and a little more change of the seasons and a few more trees, meaning even 3 trees would be pretty nice. So anyway, that's why I am where I am.
Okay. All right. So our next question, we actually have a caller on hold right now, so we're going to get to that caller. So I've got a couple of emails from a lot of the listeners asking you to comment on the sexual allegations on the current news. So we'll take the caller, and then we'll go to that question. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
AJ, LA, and my question actually is on the sexual harassment in the news. Living in LA, I'm wondering what is going on with Hollywood. You know, the casting couch has been going on forever, and this kind of behavior occurs in other professions. But first with Bill Cosby, and then, you know, Harvey Weinstein, and then who was next? Kevin Spacey, Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer. Why is it taking so much longer for people to come forward? And it seems to reach a precipice now where everybody's coming forward from abuse that happened years ago. So is this a good thing? Why is it happening? And why does it happen in all professions? Why just Hollywood?
Well, I think that those are good questions, AJ. By the way, I know who you are. I know where you live, too.
Welcome back, AJ.
Let's see. I would say one reason why this is now rolling downhill in Hollywood is because remember what you're watching now. You're watching news, and the news is driven by money. So the news is all about how many eyeballs you can get on a station. And so news decisions are being run by analytics. So if it turned out that the most exciting thing was, you know, what Frisky the cat was eating today, that's what we'd be watching. So it's going to turn out that what's exciting for people are things that are deeply evolutionarily significant. So there are things that for example, somebody's child was abducted in, I don't know, Prairie View, Texas, and there's a manhunt for some horrible human that did this. Now everybody's eyeballs are wanting to be on that, and that gets tremendous attention because that's striking the primal fears of parents that their child could be abducted, and because the human mind cannot grasp the number 300 million. It wasn't designed by nature to be able to actually catalog what that means statistically. People tend to think of the size of their world in terms of the village of, you know, they certainly are aware of what a few thousand people would look like because that's what's in their town. But they don't really see that many people in a given day. They might see a few hundred people in a day. So if a child is abducted anywhere, it increases their perceived probability that this could happen to their child, even though childs being abducted, you know, after school are like incredibly rare. And so this is, but you wouldn't think so. So if you talk to the average mom or average 50-year-old or 60-year-old, they will think that this is happening vastly more than it was happening in the 1970s. The exact opposite is true. Okay, these things were, crime was much worse in the 1950s and 60s in this country than it is now. So crime is far less, and that's because there's many reasons for that, but one reason is cell phones and cameras and scrutiny, et cetera, et cetera. So people are under much more monitoring than they ever were before, and therefore that is a significant reason why there's less crime. The people don't have that under their fingernails. They think that it's a lot worse. Why? Because the analytics, news decision making has been driven now by intelligent monetary analysis, which says put the most sensationalistic, terrifying and disturbing information in front of people as often as you can. That's the only way we're going to survive as a news show, because we've got competitors that if we don't do it, they will. And so this is now what's going on, is that who really cares if some school teacher in Des Moines, Iowa, you know, harassed some of the secretaries in the school? Nobody cares. But who do we all know? We know Hollywood figures. And so so now this is a new phenomenon. Now, another thing that is happening is there's a little cultural dam that is being broken here. And so now suddenly, if you are someone that's going to report on somebody that they did to you 20 years ago, people are going to believe it. Suddenly, it's like we're getting the idea that, of course, this behavior is not super uncommon. And so, and particularly in Hollywood, in a situation like that, where there's people that have a lot of power over other people for those lower people's goals. They want to be fancy themselves. They want to be in the movies. They want to be somebody. And here is somebody that's feeling them up. And, you know, what should they do about it? And maybe they should let it go. Maybe they should accommodate, et cetera, et cetera. So the point is that that would have been a situation. And also the people that are in positions of power that we're pointing to, these are people that there's a reason why they were climbing dominance hierarchies. There's a reason why they were trying to be rich and famous, is because they had a lot of drive. And behind that drive, a lot of that drive was sexual drive. And so there's a reason, you know, I think it's hilarious. Like, oh my God, that wealthy businessman is trying to hit on all these people. It's like, of course he is. Why on earth do you think he was attempting to be so wealthy? That was the very thing that was driving the behavior. And so we're going to find out, as we obviously will, that over and over again, the perpetrators in these situations are going to be male. And those males will be essentially attempting to execute short-term mating strategy. And they're trying to get it cheap, and they're trying to get it with the least possible fuss with the most attractive people they can. Now, I wouldn't want to paint all of this behavior with the same brush as the news media is now doing. So Bill Cosby is one thing, and somebody else that is hitting has been found to felt up some of the secretaries on the staff and inappropriately ask them out and pressure them with their jobs. That's a pretty different thing, folks. You know, my understanding is that unless things are vastly different than they're being told, Bill Cosby is a many, many, many multiple times rapist. And he has drugged people, not pressured them, not threatening them with their jobs. He has drugged women and then raped them when they're under the influence of date rape drugs. That's incredible. And that if that is true, anybody that ever pulled a stunt like that should be, you know, in bars for many, many years on one count and for life on multiple counts. So in my personal judgment, that's completely different than somebody that said, you either sleep with me or you lose my job, or you're going to lose your job. In that case, that son of a bitch, you know, is breaking law. It's he deserves to be penalized, et cetera. And there needs to be both civil and, I guess, possibly, because, you know, I'm not sure what criminal charges would be involved there. I don't even know if that's as much a criminal. It probably is a criminal act, but I'm not sure how serious it would be. But certainly leave that person wide open to major civil litigation. But it's at a completely different level there. Now, this is this trend is going to go on for a while, in my judgment. And that's because we now have seen enough of it. We know that people believe it. We also know that people are inherently fascinated and disturbed by it. And it's going to and it's going to draw eyeballs. So I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that a lack of understanding about the differences of how abhorrent these relative behaviors are, I think that's a problem. In my judgment, a lot of the women of the world, and probably some of the men too, are extraordinarily naive about the male casual mating strategy. They don't really understand it. They don't really have a feel for it. They don't really quite understand men's motives, the way we talk about here on this show. They're not really in touch with it. So, for example, I think a great example of the world's outrage was about Tiger Woods. So here's Tiger Woods, the number one golfer in the world, rich, young, handsome, strong, and it turns out, oh, he's cheating on his wife and he's got 13 women that he slept with in the last year. This is like a of course, monumental scandal. This and I can understand people being like disturbed. They thought they knew him and they thought he was a family man with a beautiful wife and a couple of kids. No, it turns out he's a dominance hierarchy climbing alpha who is looking to spill his seed as far and wide as he could. This is totally legitimate. It may not be admirable and it may be uncomfortable, and people might say, oh no, he's married, he's not supposed to do that. Well, that's ludicrous. The truth of the matter is, this is all fair game in male-female relationships, and in no way, there's certainly nothing even remotely criminal about this. And so the whole thing, to me, I can't remember who said this. Some famous athlete said, "God, you know, that's just what we did back in the day." I think it was Wilt Chamberlain when he was. Late in his life when he was being cross-examined and shamed or something, he goes, God, as athletes, that's just what we did. We went out and played, and then there was really great-looking women in the audience, and they would find a way to get in contact with us, and then we'd go sleep with them. Like, that was the point. That's why we were there, okay? And so that is why Tiger was there. And so he was simply doing what that male would do. So the female mind, and like I said, not just female minds, looks at that behavior and says, ooh, that's horrible, that's immoral, ooh, he cheated, it's such a bad thing. It's like, that's fine. We understand where you're coming from, but you're not understanding the male brain. The male brain is that human being was doing was executing a reproductive program that is a resident program inside the machine, and in no way directly harming anybody else doing it. In other words, making people uncomfortable and disturbing relationships and consequences to his family. And, of course, the thing that I think he upset him the most, obviously, was losing endorsement money. Which he lost a lot of endorsement money. But yeah, so there's going to – so I think that there's going to be continue to be a lack of differentiation in understanding that there is a 50,000 light years difference between Tiger Woods and Bill Cosby. And the sort of media outrage and lack of understanding of that distinction, I think, is problematic, you know, and I think it's going to continue to be a muddy mess.
Do you think that there's a reason why everybody's coming out now? Is it maybe because television shows are getting less ratings because of the internet and all the free content, or is there some other reason?
No, I have a feeling that I think this is victims that are basically saying, hey, if I speak up, it's going to be believed, because it's not like there's been radio silence on this issue before the last scandal that was 4 or 5 months ago. No, there was a scandal last week, 3 days ago, 6 days ago, et cetera. It's like, oh my God, if it turns out that this is actually extremely common behavior to have been victimized in some sort of a way, then if I join my voice to it, I'm not out here by myself trying to say I'm a victim. There's going to be a lot of support. So I think that that's a significant reason why that's true. I also think that there's undoubtedly there's going to be some profiteering. Some of the things I've heard have been kind of ridiculous whining. I'm not going to speculate. I'm not going to repeat what I've heard because I could have it wrong, and I wouldn't want to be dead wrong about this. But some of the things that I've heard people so-called complaining about, some of these actors and people, have been completely normal, run-of-the-mill, pretty reasonable behavior that might just be a little disturbing to somebody. But in no way would constitute any kind of an abusive situation. So unfortunately, anything that's sensationalist, there's going to be some profiteering and whining and grandstanding on the part of victims. And that's sort of unfortunate because there's going to be some legitimate victims out there and some pretty shitty people that it doesn't hurt them at all to be outed. And I think fundamentally, this kind of process is probably a good thing because it puts celebrities on notice that you're not going to be protected by the press, and you're not going to be protected necessarily by governments and by the police or district attorneys turning a blind eye because you're fancy. That by God, you know what I mean, if you did something wrong, you're going to have to answer to it. So you better not abuse your position.
Okay, well, do you think it was okay, like when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor, he impregnated the nanny while in office. Do you think, like, that's okay?
Totally fine. Completely.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. What are we really looking at here? Arnold Schwarzenegger decides to, unless it was forcible, which, of course, my understanding wasn't even remotely. So so Arnold Schwarzenegger decides to nail the one of his maids when his wife's not looking. Okay, is this a crime? Of course not. It's not even remotely close to a crime. Is it a disturbing conflict of interest that is uncomfortable for people closely associated with his marriage, including his wife? Yes, of course it is. Okay, there we have it. So he makes his choice. And there are emotional consequences to people. But when you ask me, is it okay? Of course it's okay. It's a personal choice that he makes, and there's it's between him, his conscience, and the woman on the other side of this is the maid who decides whether or not she wants to sleep with Arnold. And the answer apparently was yes.
Oh my gosh.
I got a question. Does it make him a liar or a cheater or something like that? Like, what I hear these things thrown around what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, these are conflicts of interest between men and women. So this is an interesting discussion that we wanted into
deep,
here.
So.
Yeah, the issue here is that there people have sometimes a difficult time grasping the notion of conflicts of interest. So we would like to live in a world, in principle, where there are no conflicts of interest. So therefore, if there aren't conflicts of interest, then nobody's feelings are going to get hurt. Nobody's going to feel like their rights are being tromped on. Nobody's going to bloody anybody else's nose or take their property or kill them or fire them or anything else under the sun, okay? But in fact, the world you live in is nothing but conflicts of interest, that every entity on earth has it stamped on their forehead, my DNA is the most important thing on earth, okay? So in fact, any relationship is loaded with conflicts of interest. The only question is how we negotiate those conflicts of interest and how much cooperation we can have so that our best interests can be served pretty well. In a marriage, there are absolutely conflicts of interest. Who's going to feed the baby? Who's going to change the diapers? Who's going to go to work? Who's going to clean up the mess of the spilled milk, almond milk? Who's going to do this and who's going to do that? and wait a second, when are we going to have sex and how are we going to do it and who's going to do what? And, you know, in the movie Pulp Fiction, you know, Bruce Willis character and his wife, they're talking about who's gonna do oral sex, and she says, "You first." Okay. So the point is, conflicts of interest are everywhere, and so how people negotiate those conflicts of interest and the consequences to those negotiations are going to be, to varying degrees, there's going to be varying degrees of discomfort. So Arnold had a conflict of interest with whom? With his wife. And the conflict of interest was Arnold, by being an absolute epitome of an alpha male, by the way, who, I have to tell you, Maria Shriver, would have been difficult for her to have missed that fact in case anybody was paying attention. Now, let me see. When I select Arnold Schwarzenegger as my husband, what do I think some of the consequences of this are? Do any other women find him sexually attractive? Gee, no, I think it's just me. I don't think I have any competition. Now, so Maria Shriver selects Arnold Schwarzenegger to be her husband. Okay? And Arnold, because he's in love with the girl, ostensibly, and not just a dominant hierarchy-climbing alpha that wanted to be part of the Kennedy clan, Arnold, in principle, was in love with Maria Shriver. So he's willing to stand between God and everybody and say, yeah, I'll love this one forever and be faithful. You got to be knowing he was biting his lip. Okay? Maria had to be knowing that he was biting his lip. But he did it. And so they're married, they got a couple of kids, but what's going to happen? What's going to happen is the default programming of an alpha with phenomenal resources in the mating world. And so what's going to happen? I assure you that that hot little maid wasn't the only person that Arnold nailed over that 25-year marriage or whatever it was. And you have, of course, Maria wouldn't have dreamed that this was the only person. So the only thing embarrassing about it was he impregnated the woman and kept the maid right there in the house. Now that, I got to tell you, it's one thing to nail the maid, knock her up, and then send her to live in Santa Maria, you know, in her own nice place, and nobody has to know anything about it. But to have her right there and have the kid raised right there where the kid starts evidencing cues that look like Arnold, I mean, that is pretty incredible. That guy, I don't even know what to call that, but I call it fundamentally stupid, but I know the man isn't stupid, so I kind of don't know what to call that.
To lower conscientiousness, maybe?
Yeah, there's a screw loose in there somewhere, and I don't know what it is.
Okay.
If that had been me, that maid would have been living in Miami. But... That's how that goes. All right.
Okay.
That is all helpful, AJ?
Yeah, I just Googled her. She doesn't seem all that hot.
Who?
The lady he impregnated.
Well, that's 20 years ago, dear.
Oh, okay. Maybe she was then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go.
All right, AJ, thank you very much for the call. We always appreciate you calling.
Thanks, AJ. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Interesting tangent. This brings up a lot of different questions. So I'm glad we got some of them in. And thank you all for sending me all the emails. Sorry we couldn't read all those regarding the sexual harassment allegations coming out in the news. We tried to do the best that we can with the ones that we have. Okay. So next question is, we're going to turn the ship completely around and start talking about anxiety transitioning to a healthy diet.
Okay. All right.
All right. So, dear Dr. Lyle, what can I do with the high anxiety that comes with knowing it's time to get with the program and eat and drink healthy? There's been times in my past when I acknowledge what I need to do, but just that acknowledgement leaves me to go overboard knowing that I won't be able to have something anymore. What's the best approach to this situation?
Okay. First of all, yeah, the person's feeling trapped, like they're about to be shoved into a steel cage, and and that they're never going to be able to get out. So they better grab every bit of pepperoni pizza that they can get before they you know, face the music. Now, the right way to do this is quite different. The right way to do this is to look at a healthy change in your life as, for example, a 60-day experiment. So not some cheesy little 30-day experiment that isn't going to accomplish very much, but a 60-day experiment is going to accomplish quite a bit. And so in six weeks, you know, Rocky trained for fighting Apollo Creed, for goodness sakes. So in 60 days, you can get an awful lot done in terms of your health and fitness. Now, the other thing that I want people to be doing is to be focusing on a little bit different part of this process than they might normally even be thinking about. What I'm concerned about is the self-esteem mechanism. I want people to understand that the self-esteem mechanism does not work the way human beings intuit that it works. People's intuition, people are very confused about how self-esteem works and what it is and what its purpose is. In other words, you're not going to get this story straight out of psychologists or the media or anybody else under the sun. The self-esteem mechanism is a very specialized device for an internal audience to be observing your behavior and actually sending signals to you, or what I'm going to call the self. It's as if they are people outside of you watching you and then sending you esteem signals, just as real people would send them to you if they were watching you. And in fact, when real people are watching you, if they watch you work very hard, they will send you esteem signals. And they will say, wow, you're really working hard. Okay, that's a heck of a job you're doing there. And yourself will like that, because yourself is designed by nature with an esteem meter. And the self is actually sensitive to cues from other people that are signaling that they esteem us as they observe our abilities, accomplishments, etc. Now, with respect to healthy living, other people aren't watching. The only person that's watching is the internal audience. The internal audience is effectively not you. It's effectively an outside entity. Now, it resides inside your brain. It's dedicated neural tissue to providing a virtual reality experience that other people are watching you. And so, and it will send you esteem signals just as other people would send esteem signals. And so, it's actually there to guide your behavior in a way to make your behavior more competent, so that when you, it's giving you feedback, so that when you become more competent at being able to display successful behaviors, competitive behaviors, then other people will applaud you and want to mate with you or be your friend or hire you or whatever it is. So you intuit when you're headed to try to do things more healthfully and try to maybe lose weight and get more fit, that if you start to put out some effort, you know you're not going to have any major metamorphosis in a week. And so if you're not very motivated, and you're realizing, I'm not going to have a major metamorphosis in 3 weeks, so I'm not very motivated. And you aren't. In other words, you're not going to have esteem signals coming from other people anytime soon. And otherwise, and people also intuit that the self-esteem mechanism is essentially what other people think of them. In other words, it's sort of something that was implanted into me by my parents and my whole upbringing and all these negative thoughts that I have about myself and all that sort of jazz. It's a notion, it's a sort of a hybridized, unclear notion that self-esteem is a result of your entire track record and history and all the little bumps and bruises and defeats and rejections that you've had all piled in and wounding your soul, as well as how it could all turn around that if you did something great and then other people suddenly gave you heaped of adulation, and then you'd be victorious and then it would be fantastic. And that's the only way to, you know, really resurrect your life and make it a great experience, is to do something fantastical where you have this great victory. This is just simply not the way it works at all. And yet this I'm describing the intuition that people have about this. The biggest insight of my career is that the self-esteem mechanism is dynamic. That's why my website is called Esteem Dynamics, and that's why that's going to be a major component of the title of my book, is that what I'm really interested in is esteem dynamics, because esteem dynamics is, in fact, the core of human happiness. The vast majority of human happiness is all about esteem signals from other people. And so understanding how to shift those signals is central to understanding the mechanics of how happiness works. The most fundamental component of human happiness is not actually esteem from other people, but it is the process of earning the esteem from other people. And the process of earning the esteem from other people means the skill development and accomplishment that takes place outside of their vision. And the skill development and accomplishment that takes place outside of their vision will be observed by exactly one entity, and that will be your own internal audience. The problem is that when you begin, the audience is not impressed. And when you start and even you put in some repetitive efforts, it is not impressed. You have to actually work fairly diligently for several days on end for the internal audience to start to believe that you are not just going to flake out and quit. And the internal audience is vaguely aware of how much motivation you have. It can feel how much energy the self is putting into this thing. And therefore, if it turns out you're doing a half-assed job, the internal audience will say, hey, I think you're doing a half-assed job. I don't think that your accomplishments are going to amount to much. And it doesn't feed you any esteem, i.e. pride. What I want people to realize is that when you start to try to get your act together, for example, about diet, fitness, anything in this dimension, the goal that you are imagining is what it is that you're going to look like 4, 5, 6, 7 months from now after the job is done and you're bowing naked, you know, on the beach or almost naked on the beach and everybody's saying, wow, you look really great, okay? Of course that's what we are seeking. Of course that's what our imaginations are for, is to imagine that victory and to try to get excited and motivated to try to pursue that victory. That's what we're attempting to accomplish. That's true if we're trying to become a great pianist. Well, we're not saying, wow, I'm really going to be able to do that Hannon really well. I just can't wait to be able to run those scales up and down. No, that's not what we're imagining. We're imagining playing March Militaire in front of an audience, in front of 4,000 people screaming, you know, our name afterwards. That's why we become a concert pianist. Okay? So the issue here is that, of course, our imagination is transfixed on the esteem signals that will come from real people once they see what we've accomplished. But the most important thing that we have to understand is that the core and central feature of our happiness will take place when the self-esteem mechanism observes us start to earn it. So the answer to the question is, gee, how do I deal with the fact that when I start to contemplate whether I'm going to get healthy, I feel like going the other way and eating a bunch of pizza? Answer is, hey, there will always be pizza. But for the next 60 days, we're going to say, screw the pizza. What we're going to do is we're going to run an interesting experiment to find out what it feels like to earn a bunch of self-esteem. And realize that that self-esteem mechanism will not cough it up in 2 or 3 or 4 days. It won't do it. It's not how it's built. Okay? But folks, you give me a week or at most two, and it will. And when you see the pride start to signal to you that you start feeling better, quote, about yourself, that is not an accident. And not only is there not an accident, there's no limit to it. It'll go on forever as long as you earn it. And so the most important thing that you can do in trying to turn your life around and turn away from a self-indulgent period into a period of self-discipline is to understand what we're really after. what we're really after is a deep experiential and conceptual understanding of the self-esteem mechanism, one that you can turn to again and again in circumstances where you are feeling irritated or defeated or a little bit lost and feeling like things aren't fair and you've got a tough break or whatever it is about anything under the sun, and realize, wait a second, there's a fundamental method for finding my way home. And that method is to look at whatever problem I have, whatever competitive enterprise it is that I need to get better at in order to achieve what it is that I want to get, and then I need to break that problem into small steps, and then I need to start fighting my own lethargy and work at this and diligently for the next several days and watch my self-esteem mechanism start to come to life. And that's what it is that we need to do, because that ends that feeling of self-pity and it ends the feeling of a desire for reckless self-indulgence. This is the way home. This is the fundamental solution to the vast majority of human problems in this arena and most other arenas.
Wow.
All right.
Yeah. You know, every time I'm in a tough spot, I always just turn on the podcast and listen to your voice talking about these motivational things.
Very
I think that's
good.
Enough for today. But we do have a caller on hold right now. So do you want to take a call before we end for the evening?
Yeah, let's take a quick one just in case it's quick. If it's long, then we'll have him call back another time. Go ahead.
Okay.
Let's try it.
Okay. So caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? And welcome to the Beat Your Genes show with Nate and Dr. Lyle.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and I didn't know I was having a question. I was just listening, but it's pretty funny because
okay.
It's exactly what the last caller just said, is that I just turned this on. I never listened to you before, and I have the exact same problem, and I just ate a bunch of food before I went to bed, and I have all kinds of issues with my mom having dementia, and I've been taking out work to take care of her, and I'm stressed out from it, and so I turn to food, and then I turn you on, and then that's where I'm at.
Got it. Sure. Yeah, there's a I do want to say one thing. So thank you for calling. That people will believe that the reason that they struggle a lot of times with food is that they've got emotional issues. And this is what the shrinks think. This is what the psychologists think. And this is not really accurate. This is a misconception as to what it is that the problem is. The problem is that you are instinctually built to eat the richest food in the environment. That is a chip that is built inside of animals. And so it's going to turn out that chip is unbelievably useful in evolution. So human beings have that chip, as do aardvarks, as do bees, as do camels, as do everything else. Everything has that chip. And so the problem, there's nothing wrong with the chip. Chip is perfect. But we've now transformed the environment because it's so exciting to eat rich food. We've now transformed the food environment into pretty much that's what there is rich food. And it's artificially rich. So we've turned the food into what we're going to call supernormal stimuli. So human beings are going to eat supernormal stimuli. They like supernormal stimuli. Supernormal stimuli are activating instincts in a way that feels like it's absolutely the right decision. And the way it feels like it's the right decision is that it feels really good. Now, so this is not, now we've learned that that's going to make you fat and kind of, you know, not very fit in a lot of ways and eventually might truncate your life. So there's problems associated with letting our instincts go in an environment that is not built for the instincts. So people struggling with this issue, with their instincts pulling them into what I call the pleasure trap, where they follow their pleasure instincts, pleasure-seeking instincts, and it leads them into a trap. And it undermines their health, and it undermines their happiness. It erodes their self-esteem because of their appearance, and it erodes their confidence and their ability to survive. It erodes their physical fitness. It erodes how it is that they feel physically. They've got inflammation in their joints. They wake up. They're hurting. They don't want to exercise. Their sleep's disrupted. All kinds of problems. And so then if they find out that actually they should be eating a diet that's much healthier, that diet turns out to be much less exciting side by side with a richer diet, of course. And so you have to go against your instincts to do it. And then it turns out that very often they don't go against their instincts. And then they say, why on earth aren't I not going against my instincts? And some guru says, it's because you've got emotional problems or you were abused as a child or anything else under the sun. That is not the reason. The reason is that it takes remarkable energy, focus, organization, determination in order to consistently go against your instincts. And even if you have the personality and the motivation and the circumstances that would enable that to be possible, then it turns out that if you get a little bit stressed and you don't have as much time and you've got extra burdens that have been thrust upon you, or some things have changed in your life and you've got a new relationship, so you've got a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend or a new boss and a new set of demands, suddenly this will kick you out of the groove that is necessary to make this happen consistently. Okay? So the, quote, emotional reasons that will drive people into this are the kinds that our caller talked about. Like, she's got a lot of stress because she's dealing with a lot of stuff, so that makes it extra difficult. She's not eating crap to deal with the stress. She's eating crap because as soon as you let your guard down, the pleasure trap is going to get you. So that's the correct way to conceptualize the association between emotional stress and the pleasure trap is not that we have underlying problems from our deep past or internal conflicts that lead us to a chocolate bar. The issue is we have instincts leading us to the chocolate bar. It takes tremendous organization and discipline in order to not eat the chocolate bar. And as soon as some of our resolve is attenuated by our life circumstances and our energy is decreased, then we will often fall into the pleasure trap. So that's actually the situation.
Fantastic. Right. Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. Michelle, thank you very much for the phone call and for listening. Feel free to call in again and just listen. I'll remember your phone number so we don't just put you on the radio. Dr. Lyle, excellent.
Yes.
Had a great show. And for the listeners whose show, so I posted the questions that we were going to go over on our show page. And so if you see your question there, don't worry. We'll try to get over it.
You're in a hurry to get off the air. All right, Nate. Well, very good. I'll see everybody soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.